Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, it's how we get there.
Because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go. God bless.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind, a combination of Wisconsin Eye and Wispolitics look at this week. Hey, really good Wisconsin was there. The two Republican candidates for the U.S. Senate had their second debate. Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher, Democratic Rep Amanda Stuck, talked about millennials and the future of jobs. Local government officials say they're being strangled by levy limits. The candidates in the 42nd District Assembly District special election are asked about gun controls. And finally, Senator Ron Johnson on the dignity of work. Wish I was there.
I know many of you have heard me say this before, but this isn't a game. This is the United States Senate. The docket that's at play here and what you're going to be doing on a daily basis as a United States Senator involves who lives, who dies. Does this country go to war? Are we growing and prospering as a society? Are we adhering to the principles upon which this country was founded in the first place, which basically say that your life matters, born or unborn, your rights are given to you by God, and your government does not have the ability to interfere with that. That's what's at stake here.
We have created an economic miracle in our state. This miracle has made a difference in the lives of Wisconsinites, and it's something that we need to take to Washington. I call it the Wisconsin way, and we need to take that Wisconsin way to Washington, where we are going to once and for all balance the budget, replace Obamacare, and build that wall.
I just came from Warner Electric earlier today, and they're one of the leaders in automation. And it's interesting because I think the traditional narrative is that automation is just going to destroy jobs. Well, it's more complicated than that, right? Automation also creates the opportunity for new jobs, theoretically higher skilled, higher paying jobs. So we have to find a way to make investments in these areas and win that long-term competition. It doesn't seem like we're quite doing that right now. It really worries me.
I think there's also a shift sort of in employers and maybe what's expected of them or what they will need to do to be competitive for employees in terms of providing good pay, providing paid leave, providing those sort of benefits that people want. Especially millennials want that work-life balance more. They want more flexibility. They want to be able to work from home sometimes. They want those options. So I think there's also a shift in what employers need to expect from their employees, what work looks like in the future, that it doesn't always look like going to an office from 9 to 5 every day.
Not only undocumented communities are necessary for the economic growth of our state, to keep our schools filled, to shop in our stores, but all Latinos are necessary to drive the growth of this state. And so I think it'd be, it's sometimes dumbfounding to understand how efforts for economic growth are also sometimes tied with efforts to tamp down immigration in this country.
We need to be able to diversify where we collect or where the responsibility lies for services. I mean, with the property tax, it's only on the people who own property. We have municipalities that come and use our services, come and use our parks, that come and use these other, you know, our roads. We don't have a way to capture any of that. We still provide these services to townships that don't pay taxes.
The Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance did a study. The way we fund local government in Wisconsin is unique. Nobody else does it this narrowly. We've got to take a look at alternatives. We put it off long enough.
If we're going to have concealed carry, you should absolutely have to go through training in order to do it. Guns ought to be locked up if you have them in your house. But there are broader issues as a society that we need to address. And as far as guns go, I feel like the horses are out of the barn. But that being said, we have to start doing something.
If you look at the areas that have the strictest gun control, Chicago, New York, you know, Chicago is a bloodbath on a weekly basis. And if you know, and taking the rights away from legal gun owners only leaves guns in the hands of the criminals. And I'm pretty sure that if they were going to follow our laws, they would do it already. Clearly, we have to do something. We have a safety issue. But I'm not sure that you know, I'm not sure that taking guns away from the legal owners is the answer.
All work has value. We need to start preaching that to all Americans, but particularly our young people, that the way you actually pursue happiness, which is one of our God-given rights, the pursuit of happiness, is through the dignity of earning your own success. And that generally is working. And it doesn't necessarily have to be in the profit-making private sector. It can be nonprofit. It can be in public service. But people need to have that sense of personal value contributing to their families, to their own self, for their own self-benefit, but to their families, to their communities. That is truthfully the definition of the pursuit of happiness.
Justice Shirley Abramson has mm-hmm. been an icon of progressive and liberalism since she was the first woman appointed to the Wisconsin Supreme Court by Democratic Governor Patrick Lucey in 1976. Mm-hmm. Chief Justice from 1996 to 2015, longest serving justice. She announced that she's not going to seek re-election. However, she announced, as we'll hear in a minute, that she's going to keep on being vocal and active.
Yes.
So, first, as I said, first female Supreme Court justice, longest-serving justice, longest-serving Chief Justice.
First female Chief Justice.
First, thank you. First female Chief Justice. She led the court's moderate or liberal bloc. Those terms are meaningless now in kind of this dialogue we're in. For decades, and then the court turned over the last 10 years. She's been monitoring the court electronically mm-hmm. for the last few months, and there'll be an election on April 29th for her successor. Were you surprised at her decision? Because I was.
Right after the April election, when Rebecca Dallet won that open seat to kind of close the conservative majority to 4-3 from 5-2, the buzz I've been hearing was that Abramson would run for re-election, which, you know, she's already 84, so you're talking like...
Be 85 in December.
So 85 on the ballot, but the idea was that because she has this national reputation, she's an incumbent, she has a national fundraising network, that even at that, you know, I don't want to run for office at 85, but that she would have a good chance to hold the seat because she's an incumbent. We've only had one incumbent justice lose in the last 50 years, I think it is. But if you look at, like, the fact she hasn't been sitting on oral arguments, she's been participating via phone. Her husband, Seymour, who they were extremely close, passed away some time ago.
In July of 2016, after 63 years of marriage, he was a renowned specialist in genetics on the UW-Madison campus. Excuse me.
I mean, you know, you add all these things up, and you can see why there are other things to do in life than be on the Supreme Court. Now, the question becomes for liberals, who are you going to find to run for this seat? Because if you are a progressive and you want to flip the Supreme Court, you have to hold the Abramson seat in April of 19. That then gives you opportunity in the April of 20 to go after Justice Daniel Kelly, who's appointed by Governor Walker. If you win both those elections, you flip it from what was a 5-2 majority to start this term to 4-3 liberal majority. Now, that's a lot of ifs between now and then, but this makes that seat next year so important. And for conservatives, coming off the Dallet win, taking Gableman's seat, if you can win Abramson's seat next year, you create back a 5-2 cushion. Therefore, the Kelly race doesn't really matter in terms of control of the court in 2020.
Yeah, I want to come back to who may run, but let's take a look, because she was justice for so long. Let's take a look at her statement. The statement she issued, it is the right decision for me. More importantly, it is the right decision for the state. And here she says, I'm not going to go quietly into retirement in August of 2019. When I joined the court, I was given a voice that I have not hesitated to use, the best expression or the best expression of appreciation, excuse me, I can give the people who have elected and repeatedly reelected me is to continue to speak with the clarity, forthrightness, and compassion that come from a life that I have tried to devote to service and to justice for all. Just, you and I saw all the responses. Mm-hmm. Even Rick Essenberg praised her in terms of, they disagree on everything, but he said he praised her legal mind, legal work. Let's just look at two reactions from two pioneering female jurists. Former Justice, former Milwaukee County Judge, former Supreme Court Justice Marquette Prof. Jeanine Geske, I don't know anybody smarter or who works harder than she does. She clearly was of the quality that could have been on the Supreme Court. Just a sidelight, you and I have worked to track down rumors that she was being considered for the U.S. Supreme Court at different times. And then former Justice Barbara Crabb, who also was a leading woman jurist. She was appointed to the federal bench in 1979. People should know her for the immense amount of work and scholarship she contributed. She was an extraordinary lawyer, and she did almost everything. She'd talk wonderfully to people, whether second graders or legal giants in the field. So she has been, as I said, a progressive icon. Now, you have been listening. Who's potentially going to run?
Well, Brian Hagedorn, who is a conservative appeals court judge that Governor Walker appointed to the bench, he'd already been talking about running for the next year, even before Abramson's announcement.
Yep.
Right after we got the announcement from Abramson, Lisa Neubauer, who is the chief judge of the appeals court system, she announced that she was looking at it.
Is she out of Southeast Wisconsin?
Yes.
Okay.
Her husband is a former chair of the state Democratic Party. Her daughter Greta just won an assembly seat.
Yeah.
Special election Mason in January.
Seat. Yes.
And then we have Judge Borowski out of Milwaukee, who is looking at it. Now,
is he looking at the same Dalit path that got her elected?
Well, he's not a woman, so that path isn't quite the same, but she did prove that you'd be from Milwaukee and win statewide in a race like this. Others will kick the tires. It's going to be open seat. On the conservative side, there are groups who are unhappy about the way the candidate recruitment went with this past race with Judge Skrenik, because they felt like he was presented to them as a done deal. Mm-hmm. They were going to have, by what I hear, demand a role in vetting potential candidates to see who they like before they get involved in a race, and they will send signals to whoever they look at. Hagedorn's trying to lay a foundation, looking at what happened with Skrenik and saying, okay, I'm going to avoid those mistakes. So there's that going to be going on. But who else on the progressive side will look to run? Will any moderates try again like a Joe Donnell did a couple of years ago? Those are all things to be determined. But even though we're in June 1st of the off year, you need to get something going next month. Gableman announced almost a year ago that he was not going to seek re-election. Skrenik announced a couple days later, even in June of last year, there was talk of it was already late to be getting in. So there's some pressure to kind of get moving.
And just a P.S. on the legacy of Justice Abramson. She was appointed in 76 by Lucy. She then won a full term in 79, 89, 99, and 2009. And just this P.S. on the 1999 race, she was opposed by then Justice Bill Bablich and others on the court, and she won easily.
65% of the vote.
In 1999.
She noted in her announcement that she won election each time with at least 55%, touching 65% one time. That one time was when three justices backed her opponent. There were some tensions on the court back then. I mean, it is an understatement to call Justice Abramson feisty.
Yes.
I remember before WSI hired you, made the smart decision that I would do interviews for them now and then on elections, and I had the 09 race with Justice Abramson and Randy Koshnick.
Randy Koshnick, who's now the chief of clerk, he's got a high office in the Supreme Court.
And I interviewed Koshnick first, and right before we go on to start taping with Justice Abramson, she mentioned that she knew that her opponent would get, Koshnick was going second, she knew her opponent would see her interview before he had to answer the questions. She was not happy about that. So it's something I'll never forget about her.
Yes, I found her to be intimidatingly smart. Okay, new subject. Let's talk about the Attorney General's race, and let's talk about what's going to be a central focus in the issue of untested rape mm-hmm. kits. And let's listen first to the Attorney General Brad Schimmel at his press conference today saying, by the end of this year, all untested rape kits will indeed be tested. Let's listen to what the Attorney General said.
There's value in testing every sexual assault kit we can. And today, I'm proud to announce that Wisconsin is well on its way to doing so. As of today, out of the more than 4,000 sexual assault kits designated for testing, testing is complete on more than 1,800. Another 2,200 kits are currently being tested, and the last 48 remaining kits have been now submitted to the laboratories for testing. Testing on these kits will be completed by the end of this year. Today's milestone is significant. But this work is about much more than just testing kits. It's about bringing justice that's overdue to survivors.
And just a quick correction, that was a Schimmel press conference that was not held today. It was earlier this week. Okay, JR, I'm using WisPolitics numbers, so I know they're accurate. Mm-hmm. The backlog was 6,833 when Mr. Schimmel took office in January of 2015. DOJ designated 4,165 for testing. 1,884 have been tested. 2,271 will be outsourced and tested by the end of 2018. So this is a big issue for Mr. Call. I've heard Mr. Call say in the first 2 years of Mr. Schimmel's tenure, only 8 rape kits were tested. So how big of an, before we hear from Call, how big of an issue is this?
Oh, it's significant. And it's not just because of this issue, it's because the combination of this plus the DOJ swag that the Attorney General has paid for. And maybe it's not fair to compare the two, but the ad has basically been written in the minds of Democrats of how to do this. You have an Attorney General who let these rape kits sit untested, and while he spent money on coins with the phrase kick-ass every day on them, on, I think, fortune cookies and other stuff. Now, I mean, there's a reason they do those things, you know,
morale.
Staff morale. That said, it's a bad juxtaposition of those two priorities. Now, Attorney General Schimmel has been trying to say this has been a priority. We're putting effort into it. It's good for him to be out there talking about how they sent off the last ones to be tested. The question is going to be, like, how effective is that message going to be compared to that one of where were your priorities for the first 3 years you were in office?
Okay. And now let's go to Mr. Josh Call, the Democrat running against Schimmel's statement. Schimmel's failure to prioritize the elimination of the backlog has meant that justice has been delayed for survivors and that dangerous criminals have remained on the street. Do you think Mr. Schimmel came late to learning how potentially effective an issue this might be in his reelection bid?
It's a good question. I mean, it's been an issue. It was an issue for Peg Lautenschlager back when she was her one term as AG. It really kind of began. I remember law enforcement talking about the CSI effect. That show became popular in the early 2000s, and all of a sudden, everyone wants to see DNA evidence. Like, that's the gold standard. So there was an influx of stuff that you normally wouldn't test being tested because they had to prove the jury, yes, we have this evidence that connects. So that was an issue there. J.B. Van Hollen took over and made an issue in his runs, and then he declared in 2010 that it was gone. Now, I can't say, I don't remember exactly what was actually gone, or if he just caught up with the ones coming in. Mm-hmm. But now you have the ones that have been set there, some cases for decades, mm-hmm. in evidence rooms. I mean, it's been there for a long time. It's a powerful issue for people.
And wasn't it about 2 or 3 months ago that the Department of Justice put out a press release, we are filing the first charge against someone as a result of the tests on these rape kits, correctly?
Yeah, and there's, I don't remember that for sure, but there's also this double-edged sword of, if you find people now from these kits, you can say, hey, we found somebody, and the question comes, why didn't you find him earlier? Mm-hmm. You know, how's that going to play? So a lot of questions on this.
But as we speak, the Attorney General is announcing the first school safety grant, mm-hmm. and he's at Nash Elementary and Kenosha Unified School District. The grant is $888,700, but now, as JR pointed out earlier, you have to break that down by the 43 schools in the district.
That's what the release said, so it's like
$20,000. $20,000 apiece.
And remember, when Schimmel announced, because this is a $100 million package, which sounds big at the surface, but you break it down with all of these school buildings we have in the state, mm-hmm. he acknowledged it would be an average of roughly $30,000 per building if everybody got some.
Yes.
And we're not sure who's applied yet, what it'll look like, but this is the first sign of this money going out the door.
But I want to talk about the photo op that is now occurring at Nash Elementary in Kenosha, because I looked it up. Scheduled to be there, the Kenosha School District Superintendent and senior staffers, Kenosha School District board members, one sheriff, and two police chiefs. So here's my question. How big of a political bonus is this for Schimmel to be able to go around to these communities and announce, well, in the case of Kenosha, $878,000? Pretty big
It's never a bad thing to hand out money, right, in politics?
Right.
Rarely is that a bad thing.
Right.
So, I mean, Republicans want to show they're doing something. I mean, we've had a rash of shootings in this country this year. They want to show that they're on top of the issue, and this is their way they've addressed it.
Okay. Now let's turn to where you and I are going to saddle up and go to in a few days. I have a problem with dates today. The Democratic State Convention is being held in Oshkosh today and Saturday. We'll both be covering it. Wisconsin and I will be live streaming it, and you're going to...
We'll be blogging it from start to finish. Every speech, pretty much, will get some notice from listpolitics.com.
All right. The 10 hopefuls mm-hmm. have now filed the 2,000 signatures, and a lottery has determined who goes first. They each get 5 minutes. How do you think if they go over? I mean, think about... So is the music that introduces them, does that count? When their fans stand up and shout and break up, does that count toward the 5 minutes? And at the 5 minutes, is there going to be this huge shepherd's hook pulling them off the stage?
I've been covering conventions. Like, I've gone to every one pretty much for the last 12 years. I have only seen a couple that actually came in under the time we were told they were going to end, right?
Yep.
Almost every time they go over. And that's because you've got politicians speaking.
Right.
And if you tell me I've got 5 minutes, I'm going to go six, right, and push it. Now, it'd be interesting to watch how they try and, like, you know, play the outro music to try and kind of pull them off the stage, because you can't really cut them off, can you? Or do you, like, turn the music so loud they can't hear them? Like, how's that going to play?
I imagine that's one possibility. Right, right.
I remember one convention, they picked this really dramatic, like, outro music for everybody, and it seemed to, like, inspire them to talk longer and get more, get louder. So it'll be interesting to watch. But with this group of 10, 9 we really know. Josh Pay, this attorney from Kenosha, is kind of like this.
He's a business person. I went to his website. He graduated from law school. Excuse me.
Don't know much about him.
I hope to get Wisconsin. I hope to interview him. Mr. Pate, if you're watching, sit down with us.
So it's a chance for him to kind of introduce himself to activists. But for all of these guys, it's a chance to maybe kind of woo some people. Now, look, I don't know how many people are going to be there today and tomorrow. You know, the numbers I get every convention seem to be a little inflated.
The focus is going to be Friday.
Yep.
When you have more than 15 speakers teed up, go ahead.
But it's a chance to lay a marker with this activist base of if you're really somebody to pay attention to. And then you hope those activists go home and talk about, hey, I heard so-and-so talk Friday night. He or she was pretty good. Yeah. You should think about them. Then they put yard signs in the front yards. And they go to phone banks and, you know, call for that person. They give money. It's a chance to make an impression on these people.
If you're a Democrat running for governor and you have 5 minutes, you have to introduce yourself. These are my accomplishments. This is my differences with Scott Walker. Here's how I do better. Do you have time to trash the President of the United States in that 5 minutes?
Good question. Where they want to put their emphasis, you know? I mean, you're going to hear a version of the stump speech they've been giving already. I mean, they've been doing events across the state, so you'll hear a version of that. What sets them apart? Be interesting to watch. Now, we've talked about, like, tiers in this race and who the front runners seem to be. Mm-hmm. You know, Tony Evers gets there because he's run statewide 4 times, won 3 times, led in the polls. We talk about Malin Mitchell because he's got about a union backing, and now he's getting, like, endorsements that could turn out voters in August. We talk about Kelda Royce.
You got to talk about Kelda.
She maybe has a high ceiling.
Potentially, you're the woman, yes.
We have Gronick and Walks in part because they have personal money. That's why they get mentioned a lot, you know, and other reasons too, but that's a big part of it. These other folks, like Kathleen Vinehout, has had a niche in the party before, but she's having some fallout because of her votes on some gun stuff at the end of session. You know, Mike McCabe has an activist streak that he maybe could tap into with the party, but he's not raising much money to kind of deliver a message. So can he really catch fire through a grassroots? Can you go on down the list.
And Madison Mayor Paul Soglin, you and I didn't see him at Democratic conventions up until last one. And then
nope.
He sat back and surprised us all. You were the one who...
I called him and said, hey, I heard you might be thinking of running for governor. Yeah, actually I am. And, you know, and that kind of started it. But he's running a campaign where he's going to supper clubs and talking to people. You know, and he's not really actively campaigning. So, you know, what's going on with his campaign? A lot of questions for all these guys.
Okay, you coach youth baseball.
Mm-hmm.
If you,
among other things, yeah.
Among other things, if your lineup has 10 batters, what does it say if the luck of the draw determines that you're speaking 7th, 8th, 9th, or 10th?
If you're 10th, you can leave a lasting impression, right? Last one to go.
Or first, second, go.
It's the question of where do people start to tune out in the courses, because you're talking, they're supposed to kick off the speeches, I think, at 6:30-ish, roughly, if I remember right. If the speeches go for 4 hours, like, at what point have you gone, you know, I've had enough, it's time to go to the bar, right? So that's an issue. How do you leave an impression? That's always the key. What do you say? How do you leave the impression that people kind of go, you know what? Right. I remember what so-and-so said. They left an impression on me. It's going to be a challenge.
Okay, and I think a week from today in Rewind, we should take the best lines from their 10 speeches, although it's going to take a lot of work. And we'll also have a summary of who actually files, who makes today's 5 p.m. deadline to file nomination papers for U.S. Senate all the way down to Assembly. Let's get to Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett finally making it official. He's not going to run. It ends weeks of speculation. He's up potentially for re-election as mayor of Milwaukee in 2020. He didn't endorse anybody,
but
he's not going to speak at the convention. I don't even know if he's going to be there. His statement, I hope to serve as mayor for many years to come. Milwaukee has tremendous momentum despite efforts by Governor Walker and his allies to harm the city. Now is the time for change in Madison. Do you look for the mayor to eventually endorse anybody in this 10-candidate race?
I don't know. I haven't asked that question, but it wasn't a surprise when he announced he wasn't going to run because the news kind of broke 6 weeks ago that he was thinking about it. The time from that until Tuesday when he announced he wasn't going to run, I had seen no public efforts to lay a foundation for a run. No, like, organization, nobody out there, like, even thinking about, you know, getting nomination signatures. Mm-hmm. There was no sign that he was doing anything beyond talking to people and saying, hey, what do you think? And that suggested to me was he's got concerns about can this field beat Walker, but he also had a group of people around him going, I'm not sure you can win this, Tom. Now, Tom Barrett ran in two bad environments for Democrats. One was 2010, a GOP wave year. In 2012, we found out after the recall elections that their voters had a dislike of the recall process unless it was for something illegal. Mm-hmm. And because Walker had done nothing illegal, there was a segment of the population who said, I'm not going to vote him out for that. So we had that going on. In a different environment, maybe they'd be different races, but would the Tom Barrett campaign be that much different in 18 than it was in 12 and 10? And the playbook against Milwaukee's there. I mean, look, I've lived in Indiana, Wisconsin. People always hate the big city, right? Because the big city, in their mind, draws all the resources. You know, Indianapolis is like the one in Indiana. It's Milwaukee here. They get the resources. They get all the attention. What about my roads?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. You can run an anti-Milwaukee campaign. And Walker was able to do that, even though he's county executive, in 2010 because he was a Republican from Milwaukee County. You know, he could kind of push aside, or he successfully pushed aside, some of those issues.
At the Republican State Convention, all five Republican members of the U.S. House, plus U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, was there. Here's my question. Why is Democratic Congressman Ron Kind, I've been trying to get an interview, I was told this morning he will not be there. Why?
I haven't asked him, but he didn't go before because Ron Kind is somebody who on trade, for example, is not in line with some of the, where the activist base is now. Remember the presidential, the national convention in 2016? He had a contentious address to the delegation that was there. Honestly, and Ron Kind doesn't need the activists from Madison and Milwaukee to win in western Wisconsin. He needs people in La Crosse and the down the Mississippi River. Those are where his folks are, his voters
and
are.
But he needs Congress to pass a farm bill, and mm-hmm. the House just couldn't do it. Okay, let's end this way. Trivia question. The name of the keynote speaker, South Bend Mayor?
Joe, is it Buting? Budding.
Buttigieg.
Buttigieg, yes.
Age?
In his 30s, I think he was.
36, and they say he could be the first gay president. Okay, final question. What time, if there's 15, 16, 17, 18 speakers today, does the keynote speaker go on?
Before the hospitality suites close, I'll put it that way.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Off to Oshkosh. That's Rewind for June 1.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. Sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. It's how we get there.